This week's Eldritch Lorecast is sponsored by Surviving Strange Hollow.
Do you have a story when in-character romance was done well at your table?
We're here for the drama, folks.
The drama.
Joe Manganiello's heart has sadly been broken.
I wouldn't have not liked to see a Dragonlance TV show.
Wizards of the Coast put up the dates. All their books coming in 2024.
We need some rose-tinted glasses when it's an anniversary year. You know, that's what anniversary years are for.
Wizards of the Coast has apparently signed a contract with Foundry VTT.
Well, people who love Foundry love Foundry.
All that and more right now.
3, 2, 1. Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of the Eldritch Lorecast, the number 124. That's right. We've done 100 more episodes than our 24th episode. But if this is your first episode, welcome. Make yourself comfortable. Make yourself at home. Get comfy over there. Pull up a chair to the table. Get ready to roll some dice when you play D&D, because we're talking about D&D here. My name is Ben Byrne, joined as always by James Haig, Dale Kingsmill, Sean Merwin. And Sean, on this eve of Valentine's Day, Michael J. Pastor asks, what does romance look like at your D&D table or your tabletop RPG table? Do you have a story of like when in-character romance was done well at your table?
No, absolutely not. the groups I play with are not into that right now. As a kid, definitely. The closest I can come is the adventure I wrote for Aurora called We All Fall Down, which you can actually buy on various drive-thrus. It has pre-gens, and those pre-gens have connections to NPCs within their little meta. And some of those are romantic, some are filial, various types of relationships, including romantic ones. So I included it there, but the groups I tend to play with, it's better if we don't get into romance. Let's put it that way.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. Dale Kingsmill, what about yourself?
I was going to say that there's not been romance at my table, but that's a lie. In my most recent campaign that I was running, there was a little like crush side plot that was happening at the same time, but it was just so not the focus of the story that I forgot about it. But you know, anytime that those two characters, you know, happened to be on a little side mission together or whatever, you'd give them a little scene, a little room to breathe and have some awkward interactions. And that was fun. It was, you know, a delightful little element of character interaction that I could dip into from time to time, that I could lean into instead of, you know, dark dramatic backstories. I could lean on that thing for those characters and their development and personal story. And that was a nice thing to have.
Everyone in my main D&D group is queer. We've got romance all over the place. Yeah, absolutely. Player characters and player characters and NPCs, NPCs and NPCs. I mean, we're all friends here. We're here for the drama, folks.
The drama.
Has anybody played like an explicitly romance RPG before that might not be in a fantasy setting?
No.
I have not.
Okay.
I'd love to run a Good Company sometime, though, the sort of period romance RPG whose creators
good
have
society?
We had.
Good society.
What did I say? Good Company? Yeah, Good Society. Yeah. Yes, who we had on a panel at PAX Oz earlier last year. So you should check that one out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And also they did a Fight with Spirit, which I got yesterday from Story Brewers. And that also, it's not like about romance, but there's a lot of room for romance in it. And I'm going to run that someday.
Me and some of my friends love Haikyuu, the volleyball sports anime, so much. And I need to like latch onto that spirit with Fight with Spirit.
We did once have a wedding in game between two characters who the players in real life were already married. So it was kind of like going to their wedding again.
That's really cute.
Which was very sweet. And then their wedding rings were made of silver, I think it is, to cast. Is it Warding Bond is the spell? Because one of them was playing a cleric, I believe. So then after they got married, they could cast Warding Bond like at will once per day. I think we made it. So
cute.
That's so cute.
Nice little mechanical buff.
When the ceremony spell came into to 5th edition, that did spawn a lot of marriage happening at the table. in various forms.
It's a good use of that spell, because we also had, we were kind of like, should we use this spell? Oh yeah, there's a spell for this. And we went and found it.
Getting married for the AC boost is like getting married for the tax benefits, you know?
Is your marriage a sham marriage?
Just for the AC boost.
Is your fantasy marriage? Yeah. Does the magic work if it's a sham marriage? If there's no magic there, is there any magic there?
You've lost the magic.
Have you ever heard that clip from a podcast or radio show where someone called in? They're like, yeah, I'm committing marriage fraud. My mate and I got married because we get all these benefits at work if we're married. And then they go through the whole thing. The person on the radio is like, okay, I have some news. It's not marriage fraud. You are legitimate. Like, you legally got married. You don't have to be in love to get married. And then at the end, the guy goes, oh, I do love him, though.
Oh, well, that's nice.
This is really cute.
It turned out well. Speaking of heartbreak, first little tidbit of news this week. Joe Manganiello's heart has sadly been broken because the Dragonlance live-action TV show that he mentioned once on the D&D Direct last year is not in active development anymore, sadly.
Wah, wah.
That's the exact sound that I had come into my head. How do we feel? Are we sad about this? Would we have liked to have seen a Dragonlance TV show?
I wouldn't have not liked to see a Dragonlance TV show. I wasn't like hanging on the edge of my seat for it.
Sure.
Especially because, you know, it's so bizarre because I don't need it to be connected to the movie in any way. But after loving the movie so much, being like, there's going to be a TV show, and it having nothing to do with the movie, I was like, oh.
I think the bigger question is, if we were going to not get a different show because this show went forward, would we rather have a different show than a Dragonlance series that's already been out in book form for 30-some years, that has already had a cartoon version of the first book made? Is that the road that you want to go down as Wizards of the Coast? Or might there be other things with your limited resources that you could be working on that may draw a bit of a larger, wider audience?
Yeah, like some sort of adaptation of a mega popular video game that bears your brand of some sort. Yeah,
that's fair. I mean, so for those who are curious about further details, Joe Manganiello was on a podcast where he talked about how the project's no longer in active development, citing two main reasons. Firstly, that E1, which he was working with, the media branch of Wizards of the Coast or Hasbro, got sold off. Which meant that a lot of the folks that Joe was working with there left E1. And the second reason, I think this is kind of more interesting and maybe more telling, was that apparently, and this is according to Joe Manganiello, so take it with a grain of salt, nobody at Wizards of the Coast is interested in developing the Dragonlance IP further currently, which Joe blames on, and I think he was a little bit biting with this. You know, we saw how the Dragonlance book sold, and then their quote, failed board game that accompanied Heroes of Kryn, I believe it was called, came out alongside that book. And apparently, because of the failure, in quotation marks, of those things, Wizards aren't interested in further developing Dragonlance as a setting currently, which raises two questions for me. First of all, I think you're right, Sean. Is Dragonlance the IP that people are going to most strongly associate with Dungeons and Dragons as an IP and therefore drive sales of other merchandise and the game itself? And are we going to see any more Dragonlance in the actual game itself? You know, another Dragonlance adventure release officially from Wizards anytime soon? Maybe not. Who knows?
Well, am I wrong in noting that the world of Kryn is appearing in Vecna, Eve of Ruin, as part of its plane hopping extravaganza? You know, if Dragonlance is relegated to cameo status like Greyhawk and Eberron, does that really indicate a broader strategy that a TV series would support? Probably not.
Well, it seems like they're moving in a very multiverse kind of like MCU style direction where a lot of their settings will cameo across, you know, multiple adventures.
Well, that's interesting because I was just thinking about that. I was like, I mean, surely, if they were going to lean into the multiverse thing, the time is now. Well, the time is actually a couple of years ago, but you know, it's the time is maybe a tiny bit overripe. But you can still go, hey, we have a multiverse. check it out and like throw it at people. But you have to go in hard. You have to let people know that that's what it is right away. But we're in a position where broader general audiences don't think of Dungeons and Dragons as being a multiverse. You know, half of the people who play D&D don't think of it as being a multiverse. It's you know, you go, it's dungeons and it's dragons. So they're expecting something that is pretty classic fantasy. And sure. When you come at them with like, no, this is a very specific setting, it gets pretty weird pretty quick. And Dragonlance, from my perspective, was always going to be kind of a niche fringe thing. Like it would be a cult following type of a thing. So I don't know. I think that maybe there's just a little bit back and forthing on whether they want to pursue specific pockets of the pre-existing fandom, or whether they want to pursue, you know, a broader audience that they have to kind of ensnare for the first time.
Dragonlance is a niche sub-fandom of D&D. It is a really interesting view to take on it. I think it's a true view to take on it, especially in the 2020s. But the thing that set Dragonlance apart from the pack is that it was very classic fantasy, right? D&D in its origin days is sort of more sword and sorcery, Conan, Fafhrd Greymouth, or Lankmar, stuff like that. Whereas Dragonlance veers far more in a classic Tolkienian Lord of the Rings direction. And that's part of the revolution that Dragonlance was a part of. It introduced epic storytelling into the sort of larger sphere of D&D. People wanted that kind of campaign. And people got pissed off at Dragonlance in those days in the same way as people get pissed off at Critical Role these days, where it's like, oh, this looks nothing like my D&D game. This is setting a bad standard for what D&D should be in the future. And you know what happened? You know, Critical Role followed it, right? There's a genealogical through line between those two. And so Dragonlance these days, it's got kind of a like a Seinfeld is unfunny aspect to it, right? It's like it codified all of the tropes that modern D&D is springing out of. And so it might feel a little bit old fashioned, a little bit too classic for a modern audience who wants something a little bit more twisted on its head in the way that like Arcane on Netflix was a year or two ago.
Sorry, you said Arcane. Yummy, yummy, yummy. I love
Ben's
Arcane.
Ears went whoop.
Yeah, anybody mentions Arcane or Castlevania, those are like my two touchstones for great D&D in quotation marks Netflix series.
I think this is also a good time for me to say out loud, just to preempt the comments. I mean, I don't know that much about Dragonlance. It's also very possible that I'm getting my various D&D settings mixed up with one another.
I don't either, but Dragonlance does strike me as a very classical kind of, you know, sword and sorcery, dungeons and dragons. There are, you know, it's in the name of the setting as well, kind of adventure setting. But I think they're in a weird place with making a D&D TV show, which is I wouldn't want to watch a, in quotation marks, D&D TV show, because what is that? You know, D&D is not a world. D&D is a tool set for creating worlds. And so I think they actually have a better shot at capturing a broad audience with something like a Dragonlance TV show that's kind of aiming for a Game of Thrones style thing. But how do, maybe in their thinking, I don't know, how do you then convert fans of a Dragonlance TV show into fans of Dungeons and Dragons? Or do they just stay as fans of this TV show? Because it's hard to make that connection point unless somebody in the show says, we can't go down into the dungeons, there's dragons down there, you know, or something like that. You know
it
what
is
I mean?
Also, I mean, you know, you think about Game of Thrones and it had this reputation for making fantasy for jocks, right? Like it it was fantasy for people who don't like fantasy. And there was talk about it converting non-fantasy fans or fantasy anti-fans into fantasy nerds. But I'm not entirely convinced that it did convert people into being fans of fantasy. I think it made people be fans of Game of Thrones.
Sure.
But I would love to see, I don't have the information at hand. I would love to see the numbers to find out whether it did then take those people and then they move on and they, you know, suddenly they're watching Lord of the Rings. Suddenly they're watching, you know, any, I, am not thinking of other fantasy things. Willow. You know, they're suddenly...
Well, they're not watching Willow because you can't.
Oof.
Speaking of TV heartbreak. Sorry, go on, Dale. I interrupted you.
Is it heartbreak, though? Okay, you know what? That's a conversation for another
time.
New
can of worms.
It's a difficult business trying to get people to convert to fantasy when it does have a reputation of being for children and for nerds. Those two things.
I would have liked to have seen that TV show, but I don't anticipate it would have been everything and all that he was claiming it was going to be. But
my biggest fear for that show when it first got announced was something I didn't have words to describe at the time, but I do now, and it would be Henry Cavill on The Witcher show. It would be someone who is an enormous mega fan of the property, butting heads constantly with people who are trying to make a TV show.
Yes, probably true. I mean, the Witcher is a whole nother can of worms that I could get into as a fan of The Witcher.
Other cans of worms. Willow,
yeah, and I'd probably come down as an apologist.
I'm going to make a movie called Can of Worms.
Yes.
And it's going to be awesome.
It's going to be a multiverse show.
About worms.
Anyway, sad news for everybody who might have looked forward to a Dragonlance TV show. But them's the break. Just hours before this podcast was recorded, Wizards of the Coast put up a blog post on D&D Beyond, announcing the dates of, as far as I can see, all their books coming in 2024. Not just the core books for the new, for the updated edition, I suppose, but also adventure books that they have coming down the pike. Starting with, not too far away, Vecna, Eve of Ruin on May 21st. Who's excited?
I'm pretty hype. I like Vecna. Vecna was the first big bad of the first D&D campaign I ever ran. No, the second D&D campaign I ever ran. He's fun. He's classic. He's a big lich. He's got cultural cachet right now. It's a setting-hopping, multiversal adventure, which is not always my cup of tea, but I think if they do it well, it's a fun way to tie fifth edition together. You know, this is all we've seen in the past 10 years. Let's stick our biggest baddie in and shoot it off like a firework. I'm hype.
And cool. It's for high level characters. For all of those people saying, how come we never get high level play? Now you have an adventure that starts at level 10 and goes up to level 20. So we get to see what the game designers there at Wizards of the Coast think high level play should look like in an adventure.
Yeah, okay. I didn't have time to read this before we record, but now I'm reading. You're right. It says Forgotten Realms, Eberron, Ravenloft, Dragonlance, and Greyhawk, you know, being revisited within this adventure. So that's exciting. Kind of tying, as you said, James, tying everything together. Then the next release that they've put up here, kind of a little bit of an odd one. It doesn't look like it's a rule book. The Making of Original Dungeons and Dragons, semicolon 1970 to 1977, a celebratory book, it seems like, for the 50th anniversary of D&D. Who's excited for more documentary books?
I do feel like I have enough of those.
I don't know if I do. I like that they happen from time to time. It's not like I'm buying every single one, but I think they're solid entries. I think they're good things to be publishing in between, you know? And I particularly love, like, for me, the ones that get me are when they're like, let's look at all the art. Let's look at the history of the art through this game. And, you know, other people might be into the micro history of the thing. And I just think that they're neat inclusions. I like the non-fiction, non-game inclusions in the roster.
I think this is interesting too, because it looks more like a first-person document sort of look at things rather than a let's dig into the drama behind the scenes of this person,
right,
writing this person out of the company, et cetera, et cetera. This seems to be more of a love letter to the creators as opposed to a behind-the-scenes drama. And I've already seen enough behind the scenes drama, both back then and now, that I would like to see some artifacts from the era and what they say about what was done.
That's a good viewpoint, Sean. I was about to say I'm always very wary of histories curated by the publisher of a medium, of a property. But when you put it that way, you're right. There are a lot of sort of D&D's early history exposés. It would be cool to just see a little, you know, a little gala expo of early D&D.
Particularly on an anniversary occasion.
Yeah.
That's the sort of thing that I like. I couldn't believe the way that, in my opinion, Disney squandered their 100th anniversary. I couldn't believe the lack of like nostalgic looking back. We need some rose tinted glasses when it's an anniversary year. You know, that's what anniversary years are for. You put on the rose tinted glasses, you go, look at all the fun times we had, right? And that's what I want to do. I want to look back and go, isn't that fun?
Fair enough. Well, speaking of fun, July 16th, Quests from the Infinite Staircase, being a levels 1 to 13 anthology book, bringing six classic D&D adventures from, I believe, across different realms. Somebody asked a question just before in the chat, which I thought was interesting. I'm just scrolling back to find it, from Bagsy228, asking, do you think they're doing plane hopping to see which planes people vibe with, looking to find their next, in quotation marks, build merch / TV shows about world? Are they fishing for the new most popular plane for D&D to kind of latch onto? Personally, I don't think so. I don't think they'll get that sort of data from these style of books. I think they are aiming more for a multiverse direction and trying to sell all this is D&D. You know, D&D is infinite possibilities. Do what you will with it. But what do you folks think?
If they are, it's not in any sort of conspiratorial way. It's in a very boring sort of data-driven marketing sort of way. You know, it's the way that Instagram knows to sell me travel gear because I've booked plane tickets. I mean, probably, but I wouldn't worry about it. I wouldn't put my tinfoil hat on about it.
I mean, they already do surveys that they send out once a quarter or so where they literally ask you, where have you run games? Which worlds in the past 6 months, year, 2 years, 5 years? So they get that information anyway. So I don't know if this is any attempt for that sort of phishing. I think it's, we really need to release this book before July or before September. So here we go.
Yes, and speaking of September, The Player's Handbook, quotation marks, 2024.
That was a really good, what do they call it when the music, the trumpets play as you enter
a room?
Fanfare. That was really good fanfare. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you. Yeah, I worked, I did that in the mirror before the show. Player's Handbook 2024, which is, as far as we can see, the official title of this thing, and I guess why wouldn't it be, is September 17th. 2024, a little bit after, I think, where at least I was predicting last episode around Gen Con, but not that far after. How do we feel? September release? Were we excited? Yeah!
September is very close to what I predicted, right? Starter set dropped in July 2014. I think it was Tyranny of Dragons dropped in September 2014. So we're still there. We're still in the release window.
It counts.
Yeah. Yeah, I can't wait to see it. I mean, we've been waiting all this time. We've been playtesting all this time. I'm excited to see it.
Oh, that's a good question. Is it in time? Zach Types is asking for Game Hole / PAX Unplugged.
I believe it is in time for Game Hole. I just had it up. So it misses out on Game Hole Con.
Yeah, Game Hole Con's in October, I believe. So yeah, plenty of time for that. They will have copies at Gen Con. I think it's safe to say.
Like come to Gen Con, get your early copy of or do you think more like for promotional purposes, like show people?
I don't know. This is, if I did know, I wouldn't be able to say. So this is me guessing. But when the 2014 books came out, they weren't for sale yet. But if you bought certain tickets at Gen Con to play certain events, you got a copy of not just the Player's Handbook, but all the books.
Ooh, there's a Dante, we've got content at Gen Con. Get the cameras ready. Warm them up. I hope so. That would be exciting. I think the one thing I did predict sort of semi-accurately, even if I didn't get the specific dates, was that staggered release leading up to Christmas. Of course, not to jump ahead, the Monster Manual is releasing in February. After Christmas.
Not even in time for Valentine's Day.
Well, late Valentine's Day present, who knows? And then the Dungeon Master's Guide, just to tie this all together, November 12th this year, 2024. What do we think about the Dungeon Master's Guide coming before the Monster Manual? I definitely would have predicted that to be the other way around.
My thoughts were, I read it and I did this.
Dale made a slightly surprised face for those listening to the audio.
Because you can put out a Dungeon Master's Guide without having every single CR figured for every monster. But there's a little bit more math that needs to go into the Monster Manual than needs to go into the Dungeon Master's Guide, is my guess. So
also, maybe they want the chart of sales to look like this instead of being like,
My thought on the Dungeon Master's Guide is, no matter when it comes out, I hope that they've got James Wyatt leading that thing, because his Dungeon Master's Guide for 4th edition is just straight up the best Dungeon Master's Guide out there. I hope they, I hope they reprint verbatim some of the stuff in the 4th edition Dungeon Master's Guide in this one. That was a good book.
And then the real news, now that all those date announcements are out of the way, the real news. Sean, when you're playing your tabletop RPGs, particularly D&D, and you're sitting at the table and you've been playing for sort of 3-4 hours and you're getting a little bit hungry for a snack, what is your go-to snack that you would just love even more if there was a D&D partnership tie-in?
Oh, you know what? I prefer my treats from Pop-Tarts when I enjoy my game sessions.
This episode not sponsored by Pop-Tarts.
Yeah, the partnership stuff was awesome. I'm going to wear my Converse, play with my Legos, and eat some Pop-Tarts.
It was just, yeah, use your D&D Legos as the minis.
Every new entry in that list, I was like, what is happening?
It's vertical integration, Dale.
I just want to know what makes the Pop-Tarts D&D Pop-Tarts. Is it just the art on the box? Is there going to be like imprints on the Pop-Tarts themselves?
That's a good question.
It's the flavor. It'll be Beholder Blueberry.
Oh, because that's different from the other blueberry.
In the college football season here, we have several what they call bowl games, where two teams will play each other, and it's sponsored by Blank.
I saw this.
Did you see the Pop-Tart Bowl? That was the social media event of the decade for about 48 hours. It was incredible. And Dale, you can tell everyone about it.
No, I mean, you're going to have all the details. I was just, my Californian roommate is a big football fan and was following it and sending to the roommates chat just clips of what was happening. And as an outsider, I could not grasp onto anything. It was such a bewildering experience. But there's this incredible clip where a guy goes into a toaster.
A Pop-Tart.
Wait, is a guy dressed as a Pop-Tart or is it literally just a Pop-Tart? Now I'm confused.
Sean, you need to take this away from me.
We don't want to spoil the children's belief in the Pop-Tart here, Ben. So let's say it was a humongous life-size Pop-Tart with arms and legs. After going through the entire game and being really more impressive than the game itself, this Pop-Tart went down into a giant toaster, as Dale is saying, and out of the toaster came a huge Pop-Tart, no longer with arms and legs, which the winning team ate.
they ate him!
We learned that it is the sole purpose of the Pop-Tart to be eaten. That is all a Pop-Tart wants, Ben. That's all they want. They live their entire lives dreaming of the day when they will be eaten. And we saw it happen at this football game. So we can only imagine what's going to happen when we get these treats for the D&D table.
It was primal. It was something deep and deeply human.
As someone who has not seen this, has no idea, I'm imagining like Shaun of the Dead, like the scene where the dude gets pulled out through the window. Nobody ever saw poor Robert the Pop-Tart ever again. They were like, yes, just put the suit on. It's fine. So like dreams something out of
dreams do come true, Ben. Dreams do come true.
Okay, this is dark. I'm reminded of the Rick and Morty butter robot. What is my purpose? You get eaten. You're a Pop Tart. Oh my God. Well, looking forward to those dates aforementioned coming up in the not too distant future. Just to give a quick rundown again, Vecna Eve of Ruin is on May 21st. The making of the original Dungeons & Dragons, 1970 to 1977, on June 18th. Quests for the Infinite Staircase, July 16th. And then, Player's Handbook, September 17th. Dungeon Master's Guide, November 12th. And then the Monster Manual coming out February 18th, 2025. Just over a year away to wait for that exciting one. Speaking of things that are exciting, this week's episode of the Eldritch Lorecast is sponsored once again, and very excited for this week's sponsorship, which is Surviving Strange Hollow, which I believe you three might know a little bit about. So I'm going to apologize to Sean for his cold and handball it back to him again.
Well, I am very excited to be a part of the team that is working on this project. It is being done by Accidental Cyclops Publishing. And it is all about the art of one Emily Hare, a British artist who, if you see her work, you will say, I've seen that before. And I love that, because that's exactly what happened to me when they were pitching me on this project. They're like, here's the art. And I went, I've seen that before. And I love that. And so we came together to decide what we were going to do with this wonderful art. And what I thought would be best was to put together a team of creative folks who could create fiction that would capture the essence of this art in a way that both did justice to the art, but also did justice to what role-playing game fiction could be. So I reached out to folks such as Ed Greenwood, such as Aaron Carter, such as James Hake, such as Dale Kingsmill, and Elisa Teague, and Brian Steele, and said, would y'all be willing to write some fiction based on this art and some maybe, you know, game-related things that we're going to throw at you? And foolishly, they said yes.
Yeah, I mean, listen, writing fantasy fiction from the ground up. This is a brand new world, a brand new property that has been explored only in these gorgeous, ethereal, almost impressionist watercolors that Emily Hare creates, with looming creatures and bathing naiads and the silvery mist of Strange Hollow kind of consuming it all. I mean, I took one look at that art and said, I'm already thinking of five different stories that I want to write in here. And you know, I've been champing at the bit for a chance to just be like let off the leash and write a bunch of stories rather than the individual components for RPG stories. And so for these, you know, fantasy fiction bits to be there as their own standalone thing to inspire you, the reader, to create within that world as well, to invoke the feeling, whether it's through text or in art, it's the joy of creation, the joy of inspiration.
Yeah, I was super drawn to the project because Accidental Cyclops have done this before, this thing of seeking out unusual art that you don't expect to become a TTRPG and making it happen, right? So they've previously done the Music of Faith No More became the RPG, the real thing, and now we're doing it with Emily Hare's art. And I just, there's something so weird at the heart of that practice. It's so creativity led, and I was already very interested in the project, but when we had our first meeting and Sean really encouraged us to get weird with the fiction, pick unusual sort of forms for writing in, that's when I was really deep in my heart sold on it. It's such a thrill getting to unleash this weirdness, this vague and evocative weirdness that, you know, and looking at Emily Hare's art, it's so reminiscent of so much stuff from my childhood that has informed my sense of fantasy in the first place, that it's just like this thrilling experience to be able to just like, all right, make a story first. We'll figure out how it works later. And yeah, I'm kind of in love with it.
The art is absolutely gorgeous. Vague and evocative is exactly how I would describe it in terms of its, you know, whimsical and watercolors and beautiful and strange, but not particular without being too threatening. And yet there's something there that you want to know more about. And these fluffy little creatures look like they could open their mouth and suddenly there's rows of 70.
Yeah, it's whimsy with a dark teeth. Heart.
Yeah, exactly. Having only really seen the art, what is the setting like? Like, what have you put together for people who might want to play this as an RPG?
That's where the fiction is coming in, because what we're saying is, you writers, you create something that's going to be memorable, that's really going to speak to a fantasy audience, and we are going to find the rules in there. We are going to find the conflict in there. We are going to find the thing that makes that story resonate, and we are going to gamify that in a way that no other setting has done so far. It's called Surviving Strange Hollow. So there will be survival, but it's not going to be the typical survival that you might get if you go exploring in a strange place. It's going to be far and beyond, much stranger than that. We want this to be something where a game master will read this and say, I need to run this for players right now because they've never seen anything like this before. And hopefully that will resonate. If it resonates with the game master, then it will resonate with the players, and then it will resonate down the line. And we will be bringing in more writers to design the rules, including folks who everyone, I'm not going to name names yet because we're still signing contracts, but names that everyone has heard of.
Some of the names that have entered our Discord this past week, man, I'm just like, I wish I could say.
And so we're going to create a setting in a way that we really, really strongly believe will lead to a new type of gameplay that people don't even know that they had wanted, but will definitely want more of once they start.
There's no Kickstarter date announced yet, but it is going to Kickstarter early 2024, I believe Accidental Cyclops have said. If you want to learn more about it, I'm just posting a link now to the chat. You can also find the link. Sean, if you point directly upwards, there, and in the description, the link is get.accidentalcyclops.com/4, as in numerical 4. And if you follow that link, you'll also be supporting the Lorecast. You can sign up for updates there. Thank you to Accidental Cyclops and Surviving Strange Hollow for sponsoring this episode.
We have Accidental Cyclops in the chat confirming launch date 3/5, which to translate for the Australians will
is
be
5/3.
The 5th of March.
So speaking of other, I suppose, exciting things, it doesn't personally affect me because I don't use VTTs all that much, but we missed this last week. This bit of news. I missed it last week because I was aware of it, and yet none of the news websites that I usually go to kind of, you know, get information and details about what's happening inside the industry before we record the Lorecast was reporting on this. So it kind of jumped out of my mind when I put the run sheet together last week. It's an interesting bit of news. Wizards of the Coast has apparently signed a contract with Foundry VTT to officially bring 5e content to the platform. This is interesting. The first pack that they're putting on there seems more like, you know, there's new character sheets that are interactive, an interactive inventory, which seems really intuitive, spell management, rule tips, the way that they create tokens looks really exciting, dynamic token engine, they call it. But this doesn't look like they're putting the player's handbook into it. They're putting like the base rules, the SRD rules, or the, you know, whatever makes these basic functions function. And their first official book release, which I believe is out now, it came out on the 1st of Feb, is Phandelver and Below as an adventure release for the platform. Seems exciting.
Also seems kind of odd. I mean, not in a bad way, but just, you know, we've seen such a pattern of trending towards, oh, we're going to make D&D Beyond the hub of where, you know, people go for virtual play until we get our finalized version of our VTT going. And then to just be like, no, 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 we'll make a deal with Foundry is just, it just shoots off in another direction I wasn't expecting.
These are not connected at all either. Like Foundry confirmed in their FAQ, making a D&D Beyond purchase does not give you access to that content in Foundry, you know, and vice versa. They are separate purchases from separate stores, which is also interesting. There's no, as far as I can see, kind of D&D Beyond integration.
I mean, it's possible they're still just relying that on the fact that in the long term, people trend towards, if I can get everything in the one place, I will. Which is fair. And in the meantime, you can make a bit of money on, I'm sure they've done some research and gone, Foundry's very popular. Let's get some extra money there while we can. Yeah.
Does this mean that Roll20 is no longer their preferred host?
I don't, and one of you can correct me on this if I get this wrong. I don't think they ever had a contract with Roll20. Roll20 had a contract with One Bookshelf, D&D, who had a contract with DM's Guild with Wizards. But if you go to Roll20, very often you will find that there's certain content, at least this was the case, you know, it might have been a while ago now when I was last checking, some non-SRD spells and content is sometimes missing from Roll20, at least in my past experience. I don't know if that's still the case.
I knew that in the early days of 5e, Roll20 and Fantasy Grounds had the ability to publish those premium modules like Dante was talking about that had the books and their adventures and art and tokens and content to be integrated with the character sheet. I don't know if they've kept that up. I don't know if the merger between One Bookshelf and Roll20 exploded all of that. It's I feel uneducated to really opine on this topic, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. And it's kind of the news around the news, which is almost more interesting and more relevant for us to comment on. I made a point a moment ago to say they're not bringing the player's handbook. That's not like a book release that they're doing. The language that Foundry is using strongly indicates that they are going to be publishing the 2024 version of the player's handbook. And so they are waiting, rather than do a player's handbook release now, they are waiting until they have the new rules or the new rules are released, and then we'll put that onto Foundry. There's no timeline on when that will happen, whether that will coincide with the release of the book or not. I can't imagine it would be earlier than the release of the book. So yeah, it's kind of interesting to try and it's just inferring, it's just speculation, but where Wizards of the Coast's head is at in terms of, you know, is it hard to convert people from Foundry to D&D Beyond, and therefore they can get more people to engage with the hobby?
People who love Foundry. We do have some comments from Overcord in chat saying that the 5e SRD has been around for a while on Foundry, and the 5e system is still free on Foundry, but now it's that the 5e system is going to be officially developed and maintained by Wizards of the Coast, or certainly you can now buy adventures built as Foundry content, so it's already set up for you and ready to roll. So it's a switch to a more convenient format seems to have been the thing that's come along with this deal. But we do also have some other people in chat saying that the update has kind of futzed up their campaigns that are ongoing in terms
Not
of
really.
Things needing to catch up and be updated.
Yeah, I mean, you know, as folk in the chat are also saying, 5e content was probably on all these platforms before because of the SRD. Anybody could put 5e content on a VTT because of the SRD. It was open to use. And that was actually one of the things, I believe, if I'm remembering correctly, back during the OGL debacle, so to speak, was that Wizards were trying to say, hey, we only intended this SRD for published written content, not for video games and movies and you know, other VTTs, other content people might want to make. I don't know what I don't know what point I have by bringing that up, but other than to say, like, it's always been there, but now it is officially supported and they can publish things that are non-SRD related from Wizards like Adventure Mod. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So interesting news. I'm curious to see the continued development of maps and also their 3D VTT. Maybe it's a matter of they can see the 3D VTT is just not going to be for everyone because it is an intense looking piece of software.
That is the real, I don't know, red flag perhaps that comes up when you see news like this, right? Is does this indicate a lack of faith internally in the big new marquee project? And from then the speculation becomes, what isn't impressing internally? Is it the specs required? Are people looking at everything they're offering and saying, my computer just can't handle this. I don't want to run D&D like this when I'm streaming with three other people and et cetera, et cetera. Or is it there's a lack of interest? It's like people, I don't need all of this. In fact, I don't want all of this. It gets in the way. Are they finding that this big 3D virtual tabletop really only appeals to streamers who have a vested interest in visual spectacle? I think that might be a common guess, but it really isn't anything more than speculation at this point.
No, yeah.
It could be polling great internally, and we just have this to guess off of.
Like we, you know, Dale mentioned before, like people love their VTT of choice. There's the sunk cost fallacy. Maybe they've just decided, look, this 3D platform, this 3D VTT we're working on is great, but it's going to be really hard to convert users to it. So let's also see if we can, get people engaged with the hobby elsewhere. It could be, it could be anything, but it is interesting. It is interesting. We will keep our eye on it. Our collective eight eyes between us on it. James Hake, if folks want to email us, where would they send their question emails to?
They would send it to podcast@ghostfiregaming.com.
And I'll test you a little bit more. If folks want to come and hang out with us and ask questions in person in our Twitch chat, what is our Twitch channel URL?
You'd want to go to twitch.tv/ghostfire_official, where we all hang out and chat. You'll get commentary from folks like me and Dale and Ben that you don't even hear in the podcast recording because we're tippity typing on it to our chat audience live.
That is true. That is true. Do you do
there
what,
was
what
no
time?
Hesitation in that URL. I was so impressed. Not a single moment.
He's passing the exam so far. What times would we be streaming?
You would be streaming in Pacific time, 3 p.m. Pacific Daylight, Pacific Standard Time. That would be 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And that would be some godforsaken time on Tuesday, Australian Eastern Standard Time.
Yes, and those days are on Monday. I always forget to mention the day as well. All right, let's jump into this email and then we'll do that all again
at the
end.
It's currently 10 a.m. in Australia. East Coast.
Leon's question asking, bringing player backstories into the campaign, do you have guides for your players for them to create fitting backstories for your game? How do you go about making backstories relevant during campaigns? I believe Leon's email kind of cited particularly with pre-established, pre-written adventures, that have their kind of direction decided. Do you simply change the main quest dialogue to kind of incorporate something from the character's backstory, create entire side arcs around a character? What is your personal approach?
As a DM, I'm dreadful. I have my terrible habit of, building a campaign around the characters, which is a lot of work. In terms of pre-written adventures, which I know and the person who sent in the email know that I don't tend to run pre-written adventures. For that person, my favorite fae creatures are the Pooka and the Will-o'-the-Wisp. But my experience as a player, genuinely one of the first campaigns I ever played in, I think it's still the best experience I had creating a backstory that fit into the game and seeing how it fit in, was Curse of the Crimson Throne, Pathfinder 1, where there was a player packet that just gave you a bunch of information. It was like, this is the layout of the city. Here's what's going on in the city. This is a stack of different NPCs and where they are kind of located in the city, what they do. And you had to pick like two NPCs to be connected to. I think, I don't know whether it was specifically like a thing that the DM said, you have to pick one like good influence NPC and one negative influence NPC, but that's certainly how I did it. And it just flowed so well. It gave me so much inspiration for what my character was going to be. Still one of my favorite characters I've ever played. And then, as those characters came up organically in the storyline, it would just have a different connection to you as a character. It wasn't like, this idea of like, you're one of the Harpers and so you should know secret things about the Harpers, but you as a player don't know secret things about the Harpers. So it's just like, oh, I'm one of them. What do I know? I don't know. It was different having this kind of character to character connection. With my backstory that meant that, you know, if we're talking to this, priest of Pharasma, you end up being like, oh, we have a really awkward relationship where you're like my surrogate father. And that just changes the whole scene and how it works. And I was just, that's always been something that I've held on to and been impressed by. And I want to see that more.
There are lots of ways to do it. And all of them have strengths and all of them have weaknesses, especially if it's a published adventure. The most important thing you can do, I think, is figure out what the conflict is in the adventure and try to find a way to make that conflict meaningful to the character. If the player brings their own character's backstory to the table, that's fine. You just have to be ready, both as the DM and as the player, to massage that in a way that it meshes. You don't generally need to change a lot, but you do need to change it to the point where it matches the tone, the theme, the plot of the adventure, and it matches the vision that the player had for their character. I tried session zero, right? We always say, do it, make it work. Do it, make it work. Ask the players what they want. If you can connect them to each other, first of all, and then you can connect them as a group to that story moving forward, so much the better. That's just the tip of the iceberg there, but that's how I come at it, at least on a large scale.
My approach when I plan a campaign, whether it's for a written campaign or a home campaign, is before anything begins, what would the villain do to win if the main characters never got involved, right? And so that's the core I can return to over and over again. And as long as I can do that, as long as I can find a way for the villain to bounce off the player characters, there's some kind of, you know, chemistry there, I can make just about anything work. Now, it helps that I have players who are relatively, you know, team players. They're ready to play the same ball game that I'm offering them. That, you know, it's not a linebacker showing up to a basketball game. If they do that, you know, then we've got to have some session zero communication. But if we're all more or less playing the same ball game, you know, we've got three batters and a mascot who picked up a bat. That's okay. That's fun. That's goofy, but we're still in the same ballpark. And I am torturing this metaphor, but
it's perfect.
Please, no more.
It's perfect.
But you know, as long as the players are coming in to make the game better, I think they'll accept just about anything you do, even if it's a bit tenuous, to make everything cohere. They're much more forgiving about your story than you are about your story.
That is very true. I think that, you know, there's added pressure to GMs with particularly, this is maybe throwing this out here a little bit, but I think there's definitely some truth to it if it's not overlabored, because I know bringing up Critical Role, people will be like, stop attributing everything to Critical Role. But I think the way that, you know, particularly the Briarwood arc kind of played out, and then the Chroma Conclave played out in that first campaign in particular, there were deep kind of background hooks into those stories that made players who were fans of Critical Role want their character to feel like they were being personally served by the story, which is can be incredibly difficult for a GM to pull off, especially when you have five or six different players who have five or six different conflicts, kind of pulling the story in six different directions, even spotlighting different characters in different sessions, it can be difficult to try to make sense as to why this specific figure from this specific character's background has shown up at the same time as this specific figure from this character's back, you know? And I think my approach, the best times I think the players have felt like their character is invested in the campaign and they're not just wandering off to adventure is creating a party that kind of has those relationships pre-established and has those relationships pre-established with NPCs, as Dale was saying. To just elaborate a little bit on it, my favorite ones is like, all right, we're starting a campaign and you're all the crew of a pirate ship. Or we're starting a campaign and you're all members of a traveling caravan, like a carnival troop. Or dare I say, we're starting a campaign and you're all members of a Valakan clan and your job during this campaign is to keep this village and cultivate your own village. What relationships do you have to each other? And here are the important NPCs from the village. What's your relationship with them? Because that gives characters a bond that they share from the start of the campaign that can keep coming back into the narrative story because you have one, you know, a core story that ties all the characters together instead of six. And there might be, you know, three or four little subplots within that that you can tie in as well. But everybody cares about those little subplots because it doesn't just affect that one character, it affects the whole player group. It's not, I defeated undead once and now the lich is coming to get his revenge on me specifically. It's, this lich once attacked our village and we all have, even though I fought him personally one-on-one, we all have a vested interest in destroying them because they, you know, attacked all of us, not just one of us.
And it's also, you know, it's a valuable thing to recognize that relationships can be one-sided. You know, it's that thing of like, yeah, it's, I just got a good example in my brain. It's that part where Wanda is coming up to Thanos and is like, you've destroyed my life. And yeah, he's like, right. I literally don't know who you are. You know what I mean? It's about the vested emotional interest from the character side. So it doesn't actually have to be, the game doesn't have to be about them coming for you. And another example that comes to mind in Ethereal Expanse, right? You can start off this game having been on a ship where it was mutinied and, you know, you were loyal to the old captain and you're thrown overboard and whatever. And you might not matter at all to the traitor, but for you, that's like a real stinging thorn in your side that you want to see come back around to get some of that, you know, I don't know, that validating like resolution when you do encounter that character again.
I think you bring up a great point there, Dale, insofar as not every villain needs to be a personal attachment. It doesn't even need to be particularly personal at that point from the villain standpoint. I was going to give an example, but it's basically the same example you gave, but from the old Street Fighter movie where Raul Julia is saying to whoever plays Chun-Li, the day that Bison graced your village was the most important day of your life.
Yeah.
But for me, it was Tuesday.
Classic.
All-time great delivery. Yeah. But that said, spicing that up with a couple of more particular rivalry relationships can be really good, right? Call of the Netherdeep had that as one of its main intentions going in, because what I wanted out of that adventure was to give people who played it that sense of a critical role story, right? And a critical role style story has villains that are directly integrated, like in the Whitestone arc, to the player characters' backstories or to the player characters' like immediate personal interactions. And that's what a whole rival adventuring party was there to do. They could be villains, they could be friends, but one way or another, you had a personal relationship with them that was not sort of a main antagonist relationship.
I hope that answers the question sufficiently. Leon, Sean, we will dive into you. I know you have more thoughts because you said as much, but I know that you also need to rest your voice. So we are going to wrap up this episode. Dale, because you're so good at it, what should people do if they're watching this on YouTube right now or they're listening to it on Spotify? Part of a YouTube video.
I've been experimenting trying to get the buttons to light up. It's a new feature. And it's
How do you do that?
I haven't been successful on my channel, but I'm going to use this channel all too right. now just to Go. See what works. The new lead that I have is that I should say, hit the like button and the subscribe button. Might be the key word.
Well, also maybe an American accent might help because Siri didn't work. Okay. All right.
Try to hit the like button and the subscribe button.
Great, 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 great.
It really does help the podcast out, gets us out to more listeners. Thank you so much if you've been joining us on Twitch. Our Twitch audience has been growing a fair bit, so we've had more folks coming and joining us at 6 p.m. Eastern, 3 p.m. Pacific on a Monday. It is 10 a.m. on a Tuesday, Australian Eastern Time. Otherwise, we'll be back next week on YouTube and on Spotify and iTunes and all the places podcasts can be found. I've been Ben Byrne here with James Haig, Dale Kingsmill, Sean Merwin, and we'll see you all next week.
We have fun here,
right there.
cool.